Cups for Bill and Bernardine, December 1st.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show, a look at the big economic picture around today's election with economist Richard Wolff. We'll talk about why the markets change around major news events with each candidate, how the economy responds to an election, and what we can expect with our economy with either a Trump or Clinton presidency. We'll also talk about populist movements that help shape one of the strangest election seasons in years. Richard Wolff will join us for the hour. We'll also take your calls. That's next on Letters in Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. After a long and rancorous presidential campaign, it's decision day. Hillary Clinton entered Election Day with multiple paths to victory. Donald Trump must prevail in most of the battleground states to reach 270 electoral college votes. Clinton said she was humbled after she and husband Bill Clinton cast their votes near their home in Chappaqua, New York.
It is the most humbling feeling, Dan, because, you know, I know how much responsibility goes with this, and so many people are counting on the outcome of this election, what it means for our country, and I'll do the very best I can if I'm fortunate enough to win today.
Donald Trump was booed and heckled as he entered his voting precinct in Manhattan. Trump said this morning on Fox and Friends that if he doesn't win, he will consider the campaign to have been a tremendous waste of time, energy, and money. Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein has filed a legal complaint at the Federal Election Commission against Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump's presidential campaigns. The complaint alleges the two campaigns illegally coordinated with super PACs and violation of campaign finance laws. Stein said in a statement that filing the complaint is just one step toward getting the big money out of politics so we can get the people back in. Control of the U.S. Senate also hangs in the balance today. Democrats need a four-seat gain if Hillary Clinton wins and Vice President Tim Kaine can cast a tie-breaking vote. Five seats if Donald Trump wins. Gun control is on the ballot in four states, California, Nevada, Washington, and Maine. Colorado voters are deciding on whether to set up the nation's first single-payer health care system. California votes on a measure to require the state to negotiate drug prices that are no higher than the discounted prices paid by the Federal Veterans Affairs Administration. Senator Bernie Sanders has starred in ads for the measure and made return visits to California yesterday to campaign for it. He said passage of Proposition 61 would send a shot against price gouging by the pharmaceutical industry that would be heard all over the country.
On behalf of the elderly people who are cutting their pills in half, on behalf of the children who have chronic illnesses, on behalf of working people all over this country who cannot afford the medicine they desperately need, it is time to take the pharmaceutical industry on. Tomorrow you will give them the first major defeat they have ever experienced.
Pharmaceutical companies have poured $109 million into the campaign against the California ballot measure. California is poised to become the largest state to legalize the recreational use of marijuana. Prop 64 is ahead in the polls. Arizona, Nevada, Maine, and Massachusetts also have marijuana legalization measures on the ballot. University of Wisconsin-Madison officials have revoked season tickets for two football fans who wore a costume that involved one wearing masks of President Obama and Hillary Clinton with a noose around their necks. The other wore a Donald Trump mask and led the first man around by the noose. The unidentified men wore the costume at an October 29th game. Security officers asked the men to remove the noose, but photos taken later showed they'd put the noose back on. UW-Madison officials have taken criticism for not kicking the men out. In Northern California, the Alameda County District Attorney has decided not to file lynching charges against an African-American Berkeley City Council candidate and activist in the Movement for Black Lives. Nancy Armstrong Temple was arrested early Friday morning while observing a raid on a homeless encampment. Ruben Sapphire reports.
Nancy Armstrong Temple is Berkeley's District 2 City Council candidate. She was arrested Friday morning on charges of felony lynching and resisting arrest. The lynching charge applies to an alleged attempt to free someone in police custody. Activists say they are outraged, but not surprised, that a law designed to protect black people is being used against them.
This is my first time being charged with a felony. It was not the felony I would have expected. Some of us laugh to keep from crying. And when you live in a world where you are the third black woman in the Movement for Black Lives who has been charged with lynching, you have to laugh or you have to cry.
The Alameda District Attorney decided not to charge Nancy Armstrong Temple. The other two people arrested Friday have yet to be arraigned. For KPFA Evening News, I'm Ruben Sapphire.
I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and today is Election Day after basically 2 years of campaigning. Hopefully by the end of today, or end of tonight at least, we'll know who the next president will be. We'll also hopefully know who will control the U.S. Senate, among a host of other things, locally, statewide, all over the place. But who knows? You know, sometimes these things can drag on. Well, today in this hour, we're going to be looking at the big picture and economics and how these campaigns play into economics and what we can expect in the future. My guest joining us on the telephone is Richard Wolff, professor of economics at the New School University in New York City. He is host of Pacifica Radio's Economic Update. You can read his writings at rdwolff.com. Richard Wolff, I'd have to say that on this day, I don't think there's anyone more I would want to talk to than you today. So I thank you greatly for spending some time with us this morning.
Glad to do it, Mitch, and thank you for the kind words.
And, you know, we heard in the headlines there Donald Trump being booed as he went into his polling place in the state of New York. Hillary Clinton also voting in this state of New York. They'll both have their speeches tonight. One will be celebrating, obviously. You're in New York City. I don't know. Do you get any sense of what's happening in the state? Can you tell today that this is all coming to an end? At least we think so.
Actually, New York City, for sure, but I believe New York State has absolutely nothing going on in the way of election. I mean, there are no posters in the street. There are no flyers handed out at the corner, or very, very few. If it weren't for the mass media of various kinds, New Yorkers would be doing other things today. I guess it was decided by the two major parties that New York is a settled matter, so they didn't bother doing anything.
I think we get a lot of that in the immediate Bay Area as well. And we in California have 17 state propositions. Some cities like San Francisco have over 20 local measures. So there's a lot of activity out in the community about today's election. But not a lot of Hillary Clinton or Donald. I haven't seen a Donald Trump sign. I heard of one in Oakland that a friend took a picture of, but not a whole lot there.
We see a few here in the windows, but I got to tell you, we don't see very many, and we see about equal Trump and Clinton, the few people who seem to bother or to care enough to do that. I would say you get an awful lot of comments that I've heard on the subway, walking down the street, getting a cup of coffee, about people being sick and tired of the election, people being disinterested, people being downright hostile to both candidates. That is common, but passionate interest in one or the other, no. And if you get some passion about either of them, It's negative. It's passion against one or the other or both of them that you'll be likely to hear if you hear much at all.
Well, Richard Wolff, you're one of a few, a handful, really, of people. When I first began talking to you, really right around the time of the 2008 recession, a handful of people who warned about the politics that would end up coming out of the recession. Is today the culmination of that?
No, I'm afraid the culmination is ahead of us.
Really?
Yes. I don't think this is a symptom, this whole election. The tone of it, the hostilities of it, the polarizations of it, for me, are milestones along a road where we still have quite a ways to go. And if I could jump in a little bit and say further, what's most stunning to me as an economist looking at this race is how the candidates really have avoided the major economic issues. Maybe that's not unique. I suppose if we went back, I might have said something like that about other presidential races. But for sure, this one confronts these momentous economic challenges that the United States as a country faces, both as a country in and of itself and as the richest country still in the world. I mean, that position is eroding quickly, but we're still there. We have a kind of special responsibility for the economic well-being of the world as a whole, being its largest, richest member. All of that is simply brushed aside, and you have an election that pretends none of that's there. It'll be there tomorrow and the next day and the next day, and problems have not gotten better. They've gotten worse, and it isn't going to help us as a nation that we have pretended for a year and a half otherwise.
Well, let me ask you about the economy and where we are now. Do you expect, there was maybe a year or two ago, there was a lot of talk about we should anticipate another type of crash. Do you think another type of major recession is coming, or have we bottomed out and this is just the new normal where we are now? What do you, as an economist, foresee? And of course, I'm asking you to look at a crystal ball, and no one has a foresight that is 2020. But what do you see in the future, economics?
Well, I see a number of signs. And I wish I didn't have to say this, but most of them are ominous, but I'm not going to pretend otherwise. Your listeners know that that's part of why they listen to KPFA and to your program and to me and all the rest. And if you want the normal pablum, well, turn on the normal radio TV stations, you can get that. Here's the reality. Most economists now believe that we are scheduled to have an economic downturn somewhere in the next 6 to 18 months. You never can time these things in advance, but capitalism as a system has had an economic downturn on average every 4 to 7 years. Averages being what they are, it doesn't mean we would have one now. 4 to 7 years since the last downturn, which is dated by most people 2009. But if you add the numbers 4 to 7 to 2009, well, then we're already overdue. So it's a fair bet to say we're going to have an economic downturn.
Now, is that just because we expect the cycle to do it, or are there other indicators that point us towards there?
Both. We have cycles that are part of our history that we have never really escaped, except on very rare occasions. There really is no reason today to think we're at a rare occasion. And there are plenty of specific signs, and let me just give you two or three, that people like me would immediately raise if we were on some program that asked us specifically for the signs. The 20 largest shipping companies in the world, ocean shipping, that move an enormous amount of materials around the world. Let's remember, most of the clothing that we wear here in the United States comes from many thousands of miles away, et cetera, et cetera. And those things come by means of ship. Well, here's a stunning statistic to think about. For the year 2016, the top 20 shipping companies, that's the biggest ones in the world, all announced that they will make no profit in 2016. The conditions of international trade in shipping are so bad that they will all be reporting losses for the year 2016. That is an amazing statement, given the degree to which the world is now dependent on ocean-going freight moving around the world.
Let me ask you a question about that. Sure. Is that at all in due to this growing hostility towards free trade?
Plays a role in it? Absolutely. I mean, the more fundamental reality, which we will talk about this hour, is inequality. You have moved production from high-wage parts of the world to low-wage parts of the world in a massive way for 30 to 40 years, and the end result is working people have less money in their pocket because production has been relocated to where it can pay people less money for the work they do, and people who have less money can buy less goods. And this is particularly true of rich parts of the world, the United States, Western Europe and Japan. That's the places from which business has moved. And so the people in those societies, including our own, don't have the money to buy this stuff. And that's the fundamental reason, most fundamental reason, why trade is shrinking and ocean vessels don't have anything to do, et cetera, et cetera. And until we deal with this problem of a staggering increase in inequality, making the mass of people less able to purchase, less able to function as they once did, no longer able to cover that situation over by borrowing money because we did that for 30 years and now we can't do that some more because we can barely carry the debts we have now, well, then you realize we've come to the kind of the end of the road of the ploys we've used in the past to get us through these kinds of situations, which means that if we have a downturn under these kinds of conditions, and remembering that Americans remain heavily indebted, so that any inability to get a job, to get an income, immediately ramifies because you are going to be stiffing all the creditors to who you owe money when you don't have any to pay it off with. Yes, we're going to have a downturn in all likelihood, and yes, it's going to be not such a shallow or short one. It's likely to be long and deep because we have these accumulated problems. This should have been a central part of the debate of our election. We should have had a fundamental coming to terms with the inequality that has become so severe. And I don't mean a casual remark about I'm in favor of the middle class, which every one of these persons says as a kind of wake-up call in the morning. I don't mean that. I mean a real, here's what I'm going to do if elected to really deal with this. Not some marginal adjustment of a tax rate here or there. That's not adequate. That's a Band-Aid for a cancer. It's silly. And yet we didn't. We pretend that we don't have that, and therefore this basic issue isn't dealt with, and then the collapse of trade and the statistics about shipping I just gave you and the dangerous implications for another downturn, all of those are the consequences of a problem not faced, not dealt with. And now this election just lost us another 2 years, as you said when you opened the program, when we could have and should have been dealing with these issues.
Is what you're saying about globalization mean that globalization as we know it and this run that we've seen this past 25-plus years has run its course?
I think so. I think that's becoming the consensus. There are, of course, people who are very upset about that, who don't want that to happen, people who've built their entire financial careers or their academic careers on being cheerleaders for globalization. But the real bottom line way of understanding this is that globalization, this internationalization of production, was enormously successful, but unfortunately only for the top 10% of the people of the world who did become measurably richer by virtue of it, much richer than they imagined they ever could be 20 or 30 years ago.
Did it not help the developing world, though? People, poor people in the developing world getting jobs they otherwise would not have?
It's possible. There's some of that. People who would have been even worse off if they hadn't. I mean, clearly, places like China, parts of India, parts of Brazil participated. Those who got the jobs, particularly those who got the jobs at the upper end of those societies, they have become arguably a new international quote-unquote middle class who can buy some things. Absolutely. But for the mass of people, it's been a disaster, because you have to remember, it's a simple arithmetic. If you fire millions and millions of people who earn $20 an hour, and you replace them with an equal number, let's assume, but with modern technology it's actually a smaller number, but if you assume for simplicity an equal number of people being paid $3 an hour, yes, you can talk to yourself all day long about how the people who got $3 an hour are better off because they used to live on $2 an hour. That's true. There's no way out of that. But the net effect on the world economy is a mass working class that can't begin to purchase what the working class of the world was able to purchase before, because the loss of those who were high paid far exceeds the gains to those who are low paid. That was the whole point of the relocation, and that ramifies, and in the end will become dangerous for everybody, including those workers who got jobs. Right now in China, for example, there's a lot of anxiety because the engine of the world, the rich countries buying all this stuff, that's over. That's why the shipping isn't happening. The folks in Europe and North America and Japan can't buy what they once did. They can't borrow the way they once did. And that is threatening all those jobs in China and India and Brazil also. That's why the Chinese are working so hard and so rapidly to try to build up the purchasing power inside their own country using massive amounts of credit, which is a scary, risky business. But they're afraid if they don't do that, that they will not be able to sustain the 300 or 400 million people that left the Chinese countryside to go into the coastal areas to produce all the pots and pans and automobile parts and clothing that we all consume here in the United States. But since we can't consume the way we once did because the jobs left, those jobs in China are at risk too. So you have a global economy now more than ever. And if the United States and Western Europe, the richest parts of it, are in deep trouble and have really cut back their middle and lower classes, there's no conceivable way that isn't going to ramify globally.
Now that we have a globalized economy, I mean, is there any way of even getting out of it? And if we tried to get out of it, say, and I guess, well, I guess you can argue whether or not that's what they tried to do with Brexit. But let's just say, for argument's sake, we tried to get out of this globalized economy. Wouldn't that also bring on an economic catastrophe?
Absolutely. We are in that very sad. That's why I say it's ominous. It's very hard once you're in this kind of a situation. Once you stay in it for as long as we have, we've been redistributing wealth here in the United States from the bottom and the middle to the top for 40-odd years now. When you keep doing that at the pace we've been doing it, for the length of time we've been doing it, along the way you keep closing down options, things you might have done back then, but now it's like a disease. It's too far advanced. You can't do the minor surgery that might have dealt with it in the past. You're now looking at major kinds of problems, and it's very hard, especially in a society that hasn't been prepared for any of this, where none of this is discussed. There again, you see the sad loss of this election. The election might have been an educational experience. It might have been not so much that we found the solution, but that at least the American people were treated to something like the daily diet we saw around the details of Trump and Clinton could have been spent dealing with all of these problems and what various folks might have put forward as a solution.
Well, I know this is something that you're following, and you know there could be an argument out there, and I'm wondering, and I know you know of this argument, that trade actually was an issue in this election, that Donald Trump was incredibly critical of NAFTA, said that he would renegotiate NAFTA, I think in large part because of the Bernie Sanders campaign. Hillary Clinton was forced to change her support to opposition of the TPP.
Absolutely. What you're getting, long overdue, but you're getting it, and that's why it's taking also bizarre forms, you're getting the cry of those who were the losers in this great globalization hustle that we've just lived through for 40 years. The mass of people are now clearly aware that whatever the promises made by globalization advocates, that we would all be better off, that it will usher in an era of growth and prosperity for everybody, all of this was nonsense. It hasn't happened. Your economic situation now, I mean, the median income of the United States here in the households in the United States is still below what it was in 1997. I mean, that's an amazing statement. 20 years in which the median income in this country has gone down at a time when the output of wealth has exploded. Well, if the mass of people are not participating in this explosion of wealth, it's all gone to the folks at the top. We all know that. So you end up with a society whose standard of living has gone absolutely nowhere, even though more members of the family are doing more hours of work than they did 20 years ago. And the gap between them and what is a comfortable lifestyle, let alone a wealthy one, has gotten larger and larger. Of course, they're going to be angry and bitter, and of course the kind of politicians this society produces will smell that anger and bitterness and try to appeal to it for votes. That's how the game that we called voting works in this society. So yeah, sure, sooner or later a Trump will come along or someone like him and do that. Sooner or later, a politician whose whole life has been supporting this kind of free trade stuff, Mrs. Clinton, on her own part through her husband, who signed, after all, the NAFTA agreement, who signed the repeal of Glass-Steagall back in the 1990s, she will then have to change her policy and sound sort of vaguely like she's going to be against it, because the mass of people who were sacrificed in this globalization are now very, very angry. That's why they voted to get Britain out of the European Union. You know, it doesn't make a lot of sense. It isn't a terribly sensible way to strike back against the process. What globalization was and continues to be will continue with or without TPP, so that, you know, focusing all your energy on being in or out of the European Union or for and against TPP, you understand the impulse behind it. You can applaud and be supportive that people are beginning finally to react as they might have before, but they choose odd targets and fight odd battles because we haven't had a sensible conversation in this country about what the problem is and what the solutions might be. So we really can't be surprised if the anger finds bizarre outlets.
Again, we are in conversation with Richard Wolff, professor of economics at the New School University in New York City. He is host of Economic Update that can be heard on Pacifica Radio. You can also read his writings at rdwolff.com. We do want to allow our listeners to participate in today's conversation. Again, the rules are as they always are. Diversity of opinion is welcome. Demeaning behavior and insults are not. Frequent callers are also welcome, but we do want to prioritize new callers. If men are dominating the calls, and they often are, so my friends out there, you know, think a little bit of impulse control here before calling in. If men are dominating the calls, we will move women up in the queue, and you get 1 minute of time to either make a point or ask your question, unless Richard or I engage you, and then we'll try to be as fair as we possibly can. The phone number is 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008. Or you can also do it over Twitter. My Twitter handle is Mitch Jezerich, and Jezerich, how do you spell that? Is a J-E-S-E-R-I-C-H. And Richard Wolff, give me just one moment here. I got to do a little house cleaning here. Last week, KPFA began KPFK, because we're on both stations, we began an effort to try to raise a modest amount of money in a very modest way by just asking folks if they treasure this radio station and the programming that comes on this radio station, all the programming, that they make a pledge online
at our website, kpfa.org or kpfk.org, and to pledge what they think is reasonable and possible for them. Now, it's an experiment that we're doing here, because we want to be unobtrusive as possible, but we're also trying to raise money. We need to be able to stay on the air to do the work that starts after today, which is really important. So we do have a goal of about $50,000 that we're trying to reach by the end of tomorrow. At this point, we've raised about $6,500. So, well, we're over 10% of the way, but we are way behind. Again, we're just asking what you think is reasonable, what you think is valuable to you and reasonable for you to participate and be a part of this family. To just go online to kpfa.org or kpfk.org. $5, $10, $15, if you can afford $100, $500, you know, to each their own. Whatever is reasonable and feasible for you, we're asking. What we're doing is we're passing around the hat to make sure that these community radio stations, these historic radio stations, stay on their community. So again, kpfa.org or kpfk.org. Richard Wolf, one last question here about globalization and capitalism. I would venture to say, and I learned this a lot from you, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but the history of capitalism shows us that it will always reinvent itself, and hence that's its staying power, I suppose, that it will find a new market somehow, somewhere. I imagine that that's what we're probably going to see, and perhaps you're already seeing it happening now with the decline of what we're seeing with what I guess we call the 1990s style of globalization.
Yes, I think it's a wise caution that you remind us of that capitalism is a resourceful system. It's been around for several hundred years. That's already evidence that it has staying power and that it can find its own solutions. But I do think that we're in a different moment now. I think that while it can, this crisis, the one that unfolded on the world in the latter part of 2008, has exposed its mechanism. It has exposed its drive to inequality. It has exposed, of course, its fundamental instability. It has exposed the enormous injustice of how it goes about maximizing profits, the enormous numbers of people that are serious losers in this process. It's not a win-win economic system. And while it may solve some of its problems, I am impressed more than I ever have been in my lifetime that it has opened a kind of Pandora's box of criticism from all corners about how it works and who benefits and who loses and who's in control. I'm not so sure, if I can mix my metaphor, that this genie is going to be put back in the box anywhere near the way it was possible the last time capitalism collapsed in the 1930s. I see a much smarter young population that is very clear-eyed about feeling betrayed, that it was led to believe that jobs and incomes were there, that this was a system that it was in some way the best thing the human race could produce, guaranteeing that if you keep your nose clean and you work hard and you get a good education, the system will give you a meaningful job. People are very clear that that's not the case. They don't know quite what to do yet about it. They don't know where to take their sense of being betrayed and their anger and their upset and their sense of sadness that something they had come to count on has been taken away. But I think you're beginning to see, that's why I said at the beginning, we're not at the end, we're at the beginning, you're beginning to see clear signs that folks are knuckling down and realizing big changes have to be made. Scary as that may be, there really is not much of an option. And I suspect that the years ahead, no matter who wins today, are going to see a mounting pressure, left, right, to make the kinds of changes that people have begun to see are necessary.
You mentioned the 1930s. Something that has piqued my interest in the Hillary Clinton campaign is that Clinton has actually promised what she calls, these are her words, the biggest job program since World War II.
Yeah, well, you know, the promises, as we know, come very easy. The more scary the campaign trail makes you believe.
And it's hard to do it on her own if she doesn't have a Congress that goes along with her. But I did look at the details.
And the old question that conservatives like to ask, but that everybody has every right to ask, if you're going to do a huge jobs program, let alone the biggest one in history, where do you imagine the money for this is going to come from?
Well, she's looking
How
at
How are you
at,
going
at,
to do this? At, and if the only people left with money in this society are the top 1, 2, 3%, and that is more and more how our country looks, then you're going to have to bite the bullet, aren't you, that you're going to have to pay for the greatest jobs program in the world by taxing corporations and the rich. By the way,
I think she has said she would raise taxes on people who earn over $250,000.
Right. If you look at the amount of taxes she's proposing, the rates that she's proposing to raise on them, that couldn't fund a modest jobs program, let alone one that's the greatest in the history of the United States. Roosevelt did it by levying on corporations and the rich tax rates many, many times higher than anything we have today, and many, many times higher than anything Hillary Clinton has yet proposed. So unless she's been fooling us and is going to be wildly more progressive once she's elected than she dared to be on the campaign trail, then this is going to be an empty promise unless that materializes. And I would be amazed if that were to happen. Pleasantly amazed, but amazed nonetheless.
Let's go to our first caller, Sivian in Venice in Southern California. I imagine listening to KPFK. Sivian, good morning. You're on the air with Richard Wolf.
Okay, hi.
Hi.
I agree with you, on most things. So I would say on everything probably. But I think that more and more people have been kind of awakened by Bernie Sanders, and they're starting to understand how things function. But I would like to have your opinion on what should be done and what could be done realistically right now by, let's say, Hillary Clinton if she gets elected. Let's say the Congress is willing to listen. What could be done to really, I have my ideas on this, but I'd like to hear yours. What could be done on, creating jobs? What could be done on, educating the people? What could be done? Because basically the globalization has succeeded in raising the level of life of people in China, maybe in other places where they received the job that we lost here. So there was some kind of I don't know if you can say in English, evenization, but there was some kind of balancing that happened where they came up, we came down.
Appreciate it, Sivian. I appreciate the call. If I have to enforce the rules, or then everyone's going to go crazy on me.
I'm a blabber. Okay.
Thank you.
Listening.
I hope that I correctly heard a French accent in what was said. In any case, sure, let me talk a little bit about what could be done. But rather than have it sound like me speculating, let me give you an example from another country in similar trouble to that of the United States, and for many of the same reasons, Great Britain. May surprise you that I use Great Britain as an example, but let me do it.
Yeah, where are you coming with, Brexit?
No, what I'm going to talk about is the Bernie Sanders of Britain, a man named Jeremy Corbyn. The difference between him and Sanders, and they have much in common, the difference is that Jeremy Corbyn was not running for president of the country, was running for president of the Labour Party in Great Britain, which is their number two party. They have two parties like we do, Republican and Democrat, but they're called Conservative and Labour in that country. The Labour Party is the number two party, and Mr. Corbyn won two elections over the last year. to be the president of that or the head of that party. And why do I tell you that? Because they have a terrible unemployment problem like we do. They have suffered from the taking away of the jobs to the rest of the world, just like we did, etc. His basic program has a hint for us. And by the way, I don't mind mentioning that this program I'm about to tell you about was not discussed by either Mr. Trump or Mrs. Clinton, not once, not even obliquely, even though it's immediately relevant. Here's what Corbyn is going to do. To rebuild jobs and to build them on a different, better basis, they're committed, the Labour Party, if they win the next election, which they well might, to pass the following law. And the law would read as follows. Every business in England now existing, everyone, can continue the way it is. But if it reaches a point, at any point, where it either wants to close down because it's moving to another part of the world to make more money, to close a factory or an office or a store, if that happens, or if they want to sell out to a bigger corporation, domestic or foreign, or if they want to become a stockholder company, if they're not already one, namely to sell shares and so forth, the law will require them to give their own workers, before they do any of those actions, they must give their own workers what's called the right of first refusal, namely that the workers themselves will buy the company from the employer, the owner, and convert it on the spot into a worker cooperative enterprise, one that makes all the decisions democratically, one person, one vote, etc., etc. And how will the workers be able to buy the company and convert it into a worker co-op? Because the Labour Party will commit federal funds, government funds, to be made available to those workers on the theory that if the workers themselves own and operate the enterprises of Great Britain, they will not move them to another country. They will not make a few people rich at the expense of everybody else. They will therefore create and sustain domestic demand, which in turn will create even more jobs. In other words, they have a jobs program that radically reorganizes their economy so that it would have a worker cooperative, jobs-focused sector alongside the old traditional capitalist sector. But it is a fundamental recognition that the level of problems in Britain, and they're very much like ours, have reached the point where nothing short of these kinds of structural transformations are adequate to deal with the problems that they have. When the workers themselves decide where production takes place, they will no longer move the jobs out of the country, will no longer help people in other parts of the world by savaging the economic conditions of those in this part of the world. This is not a question of not recognizing the debt that we owe the rest of the world that colonialism ripped off for five centuries. It is a suggestion that the ways of helping are not those of a capitalism maximizing profits, but of a transformation of a system where the job quality and the job conditions have to be put in the hands of the mass of people, because having left them in the hands of a tiny minority, yeah, as we do, it hasn't worked out well.
Let me ask you, Donald Trump, what he says he would do with companies that leave the United States, and let's just separate Donald Trump from this policy because I'm interested in what you think about it. What he says he would do is that he would then put a 30% tariff on the products that those companies make overseas as they come back to the United States. Would that be effective? Is that a good policy?
No, that doesn't work, because once again, what it does is it imagines, or rather fails to understand, how the rest of the world reacts. It imagines that the United States could do a thing like that and nobody would retaliate.
Right.
This is nutty, you know. I mean, this is hard to take this sort of thing seriously. If you do that, you are waging... economic warfare against all those countries who will no longer be able to sell their products in the United States, since nobody will buy them, since they're too expensive because of that tariff. So what those countries will be forced by their own people to do is to do exactly the same thing, to raise tariffs against the products of other countries so that their citizens don't buy those of others, and everybody will retaliate. And for every job that is created in the United States, as we produce the goods that we no longer import, we will lose a job in the United States as people around the world no longer buy our exports, having applied tariffs to them, and instead produce for their own consumption. So this is a wonderful idea, so long as the person you're telling it to doesn't understand that this is a game that more than one player can do, and the result is the negation for everybody, and we're back to square one. In other words, this is a level of discourse that is the expression of mass anger. That's what he's cashing in on. And he's cashing in also on the fact that Mrs. Clinton is hopelessly compromised by having supported all of these globalization proposals all her adult political life. And so she can't really go back on them very convincingly. So he has an advantage here, but in terms of a proposal, no, that's not a serious proposition.
Again, my friends, just a quick reminder that KPFA and KPFK and on this radio program, we're doing an experiment here to try to be as unobtrusive as possible and trying to raise funds to keep this radio station on the air. And what we're doing is we're asking if listeners support this radio station, want to support it with what we call a pure donation. You're making a donation of whatever you think is feasible, whatever you think is responsible to your radio station, of whatever you can afford, whether it be $10, $15, $50. Some people can even afford $1,000. Believe me, it's like somebody else pledging $100, you know, each their own. But what you think is reasonable and for yourself, and what you think KPFA and KPFK are deserving of including this radio program. So again, go online to kpfa.org if you're listening to that radio station, or kpfk.org if you're listening to that radio station as well. Let's go to another phone caller. Let's go to, where is this? Messina and Saris. Good morning. You're on the air with Richard Wolf.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you guys doing?
You're doing well. What's happening?
All right. So I got 1 minute. I'm going to try to go hard on this, and then I'll let you guys respond after I run out of 1 minute. But I want to always applaud Dr. Richard Wolf. He's always been one of my favorite economists at KPFA. I heard about University of Missouri, Kansas City. So I got my degree in economics there. I studied under Eric Olson. Dr. Eric Olson studied under Dr. Richard Wolf. So as heterodox economics thinkers, you know, I always want to bring up one of the biggest unsung reports of the election was that Dr. Stephanie Tilton from the University of Missouri, Kansas City was the chief economist for Bernie Sanders. And I know that she told Bernie Sanders about the job guarantee program and about monetary sovereignty and about how we can have, through modern money theory, modern monetary theory, we know that we can fund the job guarantee program. So taxes, as Dr. Stephanie Tilton teaches us, do not pay for anything. Taxes, all money exists as an IOU. So taxes function in a different way to control the money supply, but that's another story. And I would point people to Doug Henwood's book, My Turn, Hillary Clinton Targets the Presidency, for more information on Hillary Clinton, Clinton Cash on the Clinton Foundation by Peter Schweitzer.
Okay.
Clinton.
We gave you a little more than a minute there, Messina, because we wanted to be fair. But we can't go through all these books. And you bring up some points that prove that I'm just a radio guy. So a little over my head there, but I'll let you take that on, Richard Wolf.
Okay, yes. Everything the gentleman said is correct. Eric Olson teaches at the University of Kansas City, University of Missouri, Kansas City. So does Stephanie Kelton. She was the chief economic advisor to Bernie Sanders. The University of Missouri at Kansas City is one of the leading heterodox, courageous, independent economics departments in the United States. There aren't that many. It is certainly high among them. And so it's not surprising that they would have come up with theories that teach the basic lesson, which is putting people to work, giving people jobs, is never a difficult thing to do. I can't stress this more powerfully. When you have unemployment, you have a fundamental irrationality. The unemployed people, unless we're prepared to literally obliterate them by killing them, are going to continue to eat, to wear clothing, to need shelter, to ask for the decent life that everybody is entitled to. If you don't have them working when they are able and willing to work, then you are simply making the rest of the society work harder to produce for those who aren't working, when it would be much more rational to give jobs to the people who want them and don't have them. And we all know that that's not a technical problem. That is a political problem. The Federal Reserve teaches us right now that roughly 20% of the tools, equipment, raw materials, factory, office, and store space in this country is sitting idle. So we have millions of people who want work. We have all the tools and equipment and raw materials they need to work with and to work on. And Lord knows everyone listening to this program could immediately make a very nice list of all the things that we need to have done. Programs for our elderly, child care for all the working parents in this society, rebuilding our cities, rebuilding our infrastructure, making ourselves ecologically based in our economy. There's plenty of work to do. There's millions of people who ask only for a job, and there's all the tools and equipment that we need to have them work. Unemployment is an irrational sign of capitalism, and that's because we don't put people to work on a logical basis of what makes sense. We put people to work if a capitalist can make profit by hiring him or her. And that holds us hostage to a system that has never produced full employment, today having somewhere between 10 and 20 million people either unemployed.
This is the coordinated monthly test of the emergency alert system equipment. If this had been an actual emergency, you would have received timely emergency information. This concludes this test of the emergency alert system.
Transform a society. He believed in literacy for the same reason, that working people who could read and write and communicate would be better able to finally break through and make a rational society that benefited the majority. The vote is another achievement worth protecting because of it, what it makes possible, but without fetishizing, as we can see in this election, given all the ways that money can influence and deflect and manipulate the process from beginning to end.
Let's try to get a couple more callers in here. Bill in Santa Monica, good morning. You're on with Richard Wolf.
Good morning, Mitch. Dr. Wolf, those jobs you talked about getting the people unemployed, Dr. Wolf, are kind of hard to do when you spend $1 trillion to upgrade your nuclear arsenal. But what I wanted to say is, with people like you in the world and Jeremy Corbyn, who I call the real Bernie Sanders, with the idea that you mentioned about the workers having the right of first refusal,
right.
Do you think that... Why, and also about personal income tax, do you think it'll ever come back where you're taxing 95% of everything over $500 million? And why would people be against, why would the ordinary voter be against the idea of the right of first refusal or the right of that over 90% income tax on half billionaires?
Well,
also, one other thing.
No, we got to leave it there. We got to leave. Oh. Come on, Bill. Go ahead, Richard Wolf.
Look, the truth of your question is answered by history. For most of the years from the late 1940s into the early 1970s, the highest income tax bracket in the United States, the highest rate of income tax that was only paid by the richest Americans, was in excess of 90% for most of those years. So the idea that we can tax wealthy people at a very high rate, we've already shown that as a nation. It's not a hypothetical, could we maybe someday, somehow. We've already done it. So the only question is, can we understand how that became possible back then and why it is so difficult to imagine it now? And the same thing applies to corporate taxes, which were once very, very high, much, much higher than they are today. And so, again, can we do it? Yes, of course we can do it. The way it was done back in the 1930s and 40s was the combination of a collapsed capitalism, the Great Depression, on the one hand, and a mass movement of angry people that was organized from below. The CIO, the union movement, the greatest one in American history, two socialist parties and a communist party, together forming a very organized working class demanding these things. When you put together a capitalism in trouble with a movement from below that knows what it wants, that's well organized, that can win in elections, for example, well, then you've got a very powerful combination, and you get the kinds of taxes you want. You could get the kind of right of first refusal, Jeremy Corbyn type of policy that I just described. So we certainly have half the equation taken care of. We have a capitalism in very deep trouble right now around the world and in America. But what we lack is an organized political movement from below that knows what it wants, focuses, and above all, organizes itself as an independent political force. And that we don't have, and nothing illustrates better the point I tried to make earlier than that absence, because that's why not only we had a race between two people who didn't offer solutions to any of these problems, but we had a race that systematically excluded a third who could begin to be an advocate for the kinds of change and dealing with our problems that might have occurred. But I don't want to leave a negative impression. We have had both the Occupy Wall Street movement in 2011 and 12, and now the Bernie Sanders effort, showing that the beginning of the seedlings of fixing this situation, of building the movement from below, which can make those things happen. And my hope is that regardless of the outcome today in the election, that that will be understood by people as the necessary step to get us anything like in a position to solve our problems,
yeah,
rather than to continue to live underneath them.
I just add in Black Lives Matter, which I think has a very,
yes,
very important social economic justice system.
They are
there,
getting more and more interested in the economic dimensions, mm-hmm, and I think that's a sign that they see also what is needed in this society now.
We are close to running out of time. I do want to squeeze in Susan in San Francisco. Good morning, Susan. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. And Social Security benefits, which are 60 million Americans are affected by this. And this is the greatest anti-poverty program as well as economic stimulus program. And if our benefits, our COLA, could really reflect the price increases, we could make the rest of the good ideas fight for 15.
Yeah. Do you have a question, Susan? Just because we're running out of time, I don't want to.
Yeah. Quickly. How does he think the other good ideas are going to work without a commensurate look at Social Security, minimum wage increase?
Okay. All right. We've got to leave it there because we have about 30 seconds left. Richard Wolff.
Thank you.
Very simple. What we had with the crash of 2008 was another example of the old trickle-down economics. You helped the big banks, you helped AIG, you helped General Motors, you spent trillions of dollars on the richest, biggest corporations, and we're still in a troubled situation 8 years later. The alternative might be what we could call trickle-up. Help the people at the bottom and let the economy build on the purchasing power and the jobs given to the mass of people. One component of that could have been and should have been a massive increase in Social Security outlays, unemployment outlays, grants to children and families and so on, which would have been boosting the economy from below. It would have given the help to those who need it most. It would have been probably more effective, and it would have been more in line with those family values proposed by the very people who could only think in terms of trickle down.
Richard Wolff, I thank you.
Thank you very much, Mitch.
And again, Richard Wolff has been our guest this hour, professor of economics at the New School University in New York City. You could read more of his work at artywolff.com. My friends, again, we are in a situation that we are trying this experiment to see if there are people out there that will support this radio station in order to support the radio station. Not that you necessarily need a full-out fund drive, right? We're asking you to go online, make a pledge of what you think is reasonable and feasible for you. We're passing around a hat to keep this radio station on the air. Go to kpfa.org or kpfk.org. I thank you for listening.
Where do we go from here, no matter who won the election? Author and activist Norman Solomon will speak to this question at the Ecumenical Peace Institute's fall gathering, Sunday, November 13 at St. John's Presbyterian Church, 2727 College Avenue, Berkeley. Wheelchair access is at the Garber Street entrance. This benefit dinner for EPI starts with snacks and music at 5:30 p.m. Vegetarian dinner at 6 is followed by the program. Please bring your concerns, your challenges, and your determination. For more information or to let us know you are coming, please call 510-990-0374 or visit EPICALC.